The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich A. Hayek, continued. Cassette 5, Side 1. It would, however, be highly unjust to regard the masses of the totalitarian people as devoid of moral fervor because they give unstinted support to a system which to us seems a denial of most moral values. For the great majority of them, the opposite is probably true. The intensity of the moral emotions behind a movement like that of National Socialism or Communism can probably be compared only to those of the great religious movements of history. Once you admit that the individual is merely a means to serve the ends of the higher entity called society or the nation, most of the features of totalitarian regimes which horrify us follow of necessity. From the collectivist standpoint, intolerance and brutal suppression of dissent, the complete disregard of the life and happiness of the individual, are essential and unavoidable consequences of this basic premise. And the collectivist can admit this and at the same time claim that his system is superior to one in which the selfish interests of the individual are allowed to obstruct the full realization ends the community pursues. When German philosophers again represent the striving for personal happiness as itself immoral, and only the fulfillment of an imposed duty as praiseworthy, they are perfectly sincere, however difficult this may be to understand for those who have been brought up in a different tradition. Where there is one common all-overriding end, there is no room for any general morals or rules. To a limited extent, we ourselves experience this in wartime. But even war and the greatest peril had led in the democratic countries only to a very moderate approach to totalitarianism, very little setting aside of all other values in the service of a single purpose. But where a few specific ends dominate the whole of society, it is inevitable that occasionally cruelty may become a duty, that acts which revolt all our feeling, such as the shooting of hostages or the killing of the old or sick, should be treated as mere matters of expediency, that the compulsory uprooting and transportation of hundreds of thousands should become an instrument of policy approved by almost everybody except the victims, or that the suggestions like that of a conscription of women for breeding purposes can be seriously contemplated. There is always in the eyes of the collectivist a greater goal which these acts serve, and which to him justifies them because the pursuit of the common end of society can know no limits in any rights or values of any individual. But while for the mass of the citizens of the totalitarian state it is often unselfish devotion to an ideal, although one that is repellent to us, which makes them approve and even perform such deeds, this cannot be pleaded for those who guide its policy. To be a useful assistant in the running of a totalitarian state, it is not enough that a man should be prepared to accept specious justification of vile deeds. He must himself be prepared actively to break every moral rule he has ever known if this seems necessary to achieve the end set for him. Since it is the supreme leader who alone determines the ends, his instruments must have no moral convictions of their own. They must, above all, be unreservedly committed to the person of the leader. But next to this, the most important thing is that they should be completely unprincipled and literally capable of everything. They must have no ideals of their own, which they want to realize, no ideas about right or wrong which might interfere with the intentions of the leader. There is thus in the positions of power little to attract those who hold moral beliefs of the kind which in the past have guided the European peoples, little which could compensate for the distastefulness of many of the particular tasks, and little opportunity to gratify any more idealistic desires, to recompense for the undeniable risk, the sacrifice of most of the pleasures of private life and of personal independence which the posts of great responsibility involve. The only tastes which are satisfied are the taste for power as such, and the pleasure of being obeyed and of being part of a well-functioning and immensely powerful machine, to which everything else must give way. Yet while there is little that is likely to induce men who are good by our standards to aspire to leading positions in the totalitarian machine, and much to deter them, there will be special opportunities for the ruthless and unscrupulous. There will be jobs to be done, about the badness of which, taken by themselves, nobody has any doubt, but which have to be done in the service of some higher end, and which have to be executed with the same expertness and efficiency as any others. and as there will be need for actions which are bad in themselves, and which all those still influenced by traditional morals will be reluctant to perform, the readiness to do bad things becomes a path to promotion and power. The positions in a totalitarian society, in which it is necessary to practice cruelty and intimidation, deliberate deception and spying, are numerous. Neither the Gestapo nor the administration of a concentration camp, neither the Ministry of Propaganda nor the SA or SS, or their Italian or Russian counterparts, are suitable places for the exercise of humanitarian feelings. Yet it is through positions like these that the road to the highest positions in the totalitarian state leads. It is only too true when a distinguished American economist concludes from a similar brief enumeration of the duties of the authorities of a collectivist state that they would have to do these things whether they wanted to or not, and the probability of the people in power being individuals who would dislike the possession and exercise of power is on a level with the probability that an extremely tender-hearted person would get the job of whipping master in a slave plantation. We cannot, however, exhaust this subject here. The problem of the selection of the leaders is closely bound up with a wide problem of selection according to the opinions held, or rather according to the readiness with which a person conforms to an ever-changing set of doctrines. And this leads us to one of the most characteristic moral features of totalitarianism, its relation to, and its effect on, all the virtues falling under the general heading of truthfulness. This is so big a subject that it requires a separate chapter. Chapter 11. The End of Truth. It is significant that the nationalization of thought has proceeded everywhere pari passu with the nationalization of industry. E. H. Carr. The most effective way of making everybody serve the single system of ends toward which the social plan is directed is to make everybody believe in those ends. To make a totalitarian system function efficiently, it is not enough that everybody should be forced to work for the same ends. It is essential that the people should come to regard them as their own ends. Although the beliefs must be chosen for the people and imposed upon them, they must become their beliefs, a generally accepted creed which makes the individuals as far as possible act spontaneously in the way the planner wants. If the feeling of oppression in totalitarian countries is in general much less acute than most people in liberal countries imagine, this is because the totalitarian governments succeed to a high degree in making people think as they want them to. This is, of course, brought about by the various forms of propaganda. Its technique is now so familiar that we need say little about it. The only point that needs to be stressed is that neither propaganda in itself nor the techniques employed are peculiar to totalitarianism, and that what so completely changes its nature and effect in a totalitarian state is that all propaganda serves the same goal, that all the instruments of propaganda are coordinated to influence the individuals in the same direction and to produce the characteristic Gleichschaltung of all minds. As a result, the effect of propaganda in totalitarian countries is different not only in magnitude, but in kind from that of the propaganda made for different ends by independent and competing agencies. If all the sources of current information are effectively under one single control, it is no longer a question of merely persuading the people of this or that. The skillful propagandist then has power to mold their minds in any direction he chooses, and even the most intelligent and independent people cannot entirely escape that influence if they are long isolated from all other sources of information. While in the totalitarian states this status of propaganda gives it a unique power over the minds of the people, the peculiar moral effects arise not from the technique, but from the object and scope of totalitarian propaganda. If it could be confined to indoctrinating the people with the whole system of values toward which the social effort is directed, propaganda would represent merely a particular manifestation of the characteristic features of collectivist morals which we have already considered. If its object were merely to teach the people a definite and comprehensive moral code, the problem would be solely whether this moral code is good or bad. We have seen that the moral code of a totalitarian society is not likely to appeal to us. that even the striving for equality by means of a directed economy can result only in officially enforced inequality, an authoritarian determination of status of each individual in a new hierarchical order, and that most of the humanitarian elements of our morals, the respect for human life, for the weak, and for the individual generally, will disappear. However repellent this may be to most people, and though it involves a change in moral standards, it is not necessarily entirely anti-moral. Some features of such a system may even appeal to the sternest moralists of a conservative tint, and seem to them preferable to the softer standards of a liberal society. The moral consequences of totalitarian propaganda, which we must now consider, are, however, of an even more profound kind. They are destructive of all morals because they undermine one of the foundations of all morals, the sense of and the respect for truth. In the nature of its task, totalitarian propaganda cannot confine itself to values, to questions of opinion and moral convictions in which the individual always will conform more or less to the views ruling his community, but must extend to questions of fact where human intelligence is involved in a different way. This is so, first, because in order to induce people to accept the official values, these must be justified, or shown to be connected with the values already held by the people, which usually will involve assertions about causal connections between means and ends. And second, because the distinction between ends and means, between the goal aimed at and the measures taken to achieve it, is in fact never so clear-cut and definite as any general discussion of these problems is likely to suggest, and because, therefore, people must be brought to agree not only with the ultimate aims, but also with the views about the facts and the possibilities on which the particular measures are based. We have seen that agreement on that complete ethical code, that all-comprehensive system of values which is implicit in an economic plan, does not exist in a free society but would have to be created. But we must not assume that the planner will approach his task aware of that need, or that even if he were aware of it, it would be possible to create such a comprehensive code in advance. He only finds out about the conflicts between different needs as he goes along, and he has to make his decisions as the necessity arises. The code of values guiding his decisions does not exist in abstracto before the decisions have to be made. It has to be created with the particular decisions. We have also seen how this inability to separate the general problem of values from the particular decisions makes it impossible that a democratic body, while unable to decide the technical details of a plan, should yet determine the values guiding it. And while the planning authority will constantly have to decide issues on merits about which there exist no definite moral rules, it will have to justify its decisions to the people, or at least have somehow to make the people believe that they are the right decisions. Although those responsible for a decision may have been guided by no more than prejudice, some guiding principle will have to be stated publicly if the community is not merely passively to submit, but actively to support the measure. The need to rationalize the likes and dislikes which, for lack of anything else, must guide the planner in many of his decisions, and the necessity of stating his reasons in a form in which they will appeal to as many people as possible, will force him to construct theories, that is, assertions about the connections between facts, which then become an integral part of the governing doctrine. This process of creating a myth to justify his action need not be conscious. The totalitarian leader may be guided merely by an instinctive dislike of the state of things he has found and a desire to create a new hierarchical order which conforms better to his conception of merit. He may merely know that he dislikes the Jews, who seem to be so successful in an order which did not provide a satisfactory place for him, and that he loves and admires the tall blonde man, the aristocratic figure of the novels of his youth. So he will readily embrace theories which seem to provide a rational justification for the prejudices which he shares with many of his fellows. Thus a pseudo-scientific theory becomes part of the official creed which to a greater or lesser degree directs everybody's action. Or the widespread dislike of the industrial civilization and a romantic yearning for country life, together with a probably erroneous idea about the special value of country people as soldiers, provide the basis for another myth, Blut und Boden, blood and soil, expressing not merely ultimate values, but a whole host of beliefs about cause and effect, which once they have become ideals directing the activity of the whole community, must not be questioned. The need for such official doctrines as an instrument of directing and rallying the efforts of the people has been clearly foreseen by the various theoreticians of the totalitarian system. Plato's noble lies and Sorel's myths served the same purpose as the racial doctrine of the Nazis or the theory of the corporative state of Mussolini. They are all necessarily based on particular views about facts, which are then elaborated into scientific theories in order to justify a preconceived opinion. The most effective way of making people accept the validity of values they are to is to them that they are really the same as those which they, or at least the best among them, have always held, but which were not properly understood or recognized before. The people are made to transfer their allegiance from the old gods to the new under the pretense that the new gods really are what their sound instinct had always told them, but what before they had only dimly seen. And the most efficient technique to this end is to use the old words but change their meaning. Few traits of totalitarian regimes are at the same time so confusing to the superficial observer and yet so characteristic of the whole intellectual climate as the complete perversion of language, the change of meaning of the words by which the ideals of the new regimes are expressed. The worst sufferer in this respect is, of course, the word liberty. It is a word used as freely in totalitarian states as elsewhere. Indeed, it could almost be said, and it should serve as a warning to us to be on our guard against all the tempters who promise us new liberties for old, that wherever liberty as we understand it has been destroyed, this has almost always been done in the name of some new freedom promised to the people. Even among us we have planners for freedom who promise us a collective freedom for the group, the nature of which may be gathered from the fact that its advocate finds it necessary to assure us that naturally the advent of planned freedom does not mean that all earlier forms of freedom must be abolished. Dr. Karl Mannheim, from whose work these sentences are taken, at least warns us that a conception of freedom modeled on the preceding age is an obstacle to any real understanding of the problem. But his use of the word freedom is as misleading as it is in the mouth of totalitarian politicians. Like their freedom, the collective freedom he offers us is not the freedom of the members of society, but the unlimited freedom of the planner to do with society what he pleases. Footnote. Peter Drucker correctly observes that the less freedom there is, the more there is talk of the new freedom. Yet this new freedom is a mere word which covers the exact contradiction of all that Europe ever understood by freedom. The new freedom which is preached in Europe is, however, the right of the majority against the individual. It is the confusion of freedom with power carried to the extreme. In this particular case, the perversion of the meaning of the word has, of course, been well prepared by a long line of German philosophers, and not least by many of the theoreticians of socialism. But freedom or liberty are by no means the only words whose meaning has been changed into their opposites to make them serve as instruments of totalitarian propaganda. We have already seen how the same happens to justice and law, right and equality. The list could be extended until it includes almost all moral and political terms in general use. If one has not oneself experienced this process, it is difficult to appreciate the magnitude of this change of the meaning of words, the confusion which it causes, and the barriers to any rational discussion which it creates. It has to be seen to be understood how if one of two brothers embraces the new faith, after a short while he appears to speak a different language which makes any real communication between them impossible. And the confusion becomes worse because this change of meaning of the words describing political ideals is not a single event but a continuous process, a technique employed consciously or unconsciously to direct the people. Gradually, as this process continues, the whole language becomes despoiled and words become empty shells deprived of any definite meaning, as capable of denoting one thing as its opposite, and used solely for the emotional associations which still adhere to them. It is not difficult to deprive the great majority of independent thought, but the minority who will retain an inclination to criticize must also be silenced. We have already seen why coercion cannot be confined to the acceptance of the ethical code underlying the plan according to which all social activity is directed. Since many parts of this code will never be explicitly stated, since many parts of the guiding scale of values will exist only implicitly in the plan itself in every detail, In fact, every act of the government must become sacrosanct and exempt from criticism. If the people are to support the common effort without hesitation, they must be convinced that not only the end aimed at, but also the means chosen are the right ones. The official creed, to which adherence must be enforced, will therefore comprise all the views about facts on which the plan is based. Public criticism, or even expressions of doubt, must be suppressed because they tend to weaken public support. As the Webb's report of the position in every Russian enterprise, whilst the work is in progress, any public expression of doubt, or even fear that the plan will not be successful, is an act of disloyalty and even of treachery, because of its possible effect on the will and on the efforts of the rest of the staff. When the doubt or fear expressed concerns not the success of a particular enterprise, but of the whole social plan, it must be treated even more as sabotage. Facts and theories must thus become no less the object of an official doctrine than views about values. And the whole apparatus for spreading knowledge, the schools and the press, radio and motion picture, will be used exclusively to spread those views which, whether true or false, will strengthen the belief in the rightness of the decisions taken by the authority, and all information that might cause doubt or hesitation will be withheld. The probable effect on the people's loyalty to the system becomes the only criterion for deciding whether a particular piece of information is to be published or suppressed. The situation in a totalitarian state is permanently, and in all fields, the same that it is elsewhere in some fields in wartime. Everything which might cause doubt about the wisdom of the government or create discontent will be kept from the people. The basis of unfavorable comparisons with conditions elsewhere, the knowledge of possible alternatives to the course actually taken, information which might suggest failure on the part of the government to live up to its promises or to take advantage of opportunities to improve conditions, all will be suppressed. There is consequently no field where the systematic control of information will not be practiced and uniformity of views not enforced. This applies even to fields apparently most remote from any political interests and particularly to all the sciences, even the most abstract. That in the disciplines dealing directly with human affairs and therefore most immediately affecting political views, such as history, law, or economics, the disinterested search for truth cannot be allowed in a totalitarian system, and the vindication of the official views becomes the sole object, is easily seen and has been amply confirmed by experience. These disciplines have indeed, in all totalitarian countries, become the most fertile factories of the official myths which the rulers use to guide the minds and wills of their subjects. It is not surprising that in these spheres, even the pretense that they search for truth is abandoned and that the authorities decide what doctrines ought to be taught and published. Totalitarian control of opinion extends, however, also to subjects which at first seem to have no political significance. Sometimes it is difficult to explain why particular doctrines should be officially proscribed or why others should be encouraged, and it is curious that these likes and dislikes are apparently somewhat similar in the different totalitarian systems. In particular, they all seem to have in common an intense dislike of the more abstract forms of thought, a dislike characteristically also shown by many of the collectivists among our scientists. Whether the theory of relativity is represented as a Semitic attack on the foundation of Christian and Nordic physics, or opposed because it is in conflict with dialectical materialism and Marxist dogma, comes very much to the same thing. Nor does it make much difference whether certain theorems of mathematical statistics are attacked because they form part of the class struggle on the ideological frontier and are a product of the historical role of mathematics as the servant of the bourgeoisie, or whether the whole subject is condemned because it provides no guarantee that it will serve the interest of the people. It seems that pure mathematics is no less a victim, and that even the holding of particular views about the nature of continuity can be ascribed to bourgeois prejudices. According to the Webb's, the Journal for Marxist-Leninist Natural Sciences has the following slogans: "We stand for party in mathematics. We stand for the purity of Marxist-Leninist theory in surgery." The situation seems to be very similar in Germany. The Journal of the National Socialist Association of Mathematicians is full of party in mathematics, and one of the best-known German physicists, the Nobel Prizeman Leonard, has summed up his life work under the title German Physics in 4 volumes. It is entirely in keeping with the whole spirit of totalitarianism that it condemns any human activity done for its own sake and without ulterior purpose. Science for science's sake, art for art's sake, are equally abhorrent to the Nazis, our socialist intellectuals, and the communists. Every activity must derive its justification from a conscious social purpose. There must be no spontaneous, unguided activity, because it might produce results which cannot be foreseen and for which the plan does not provide. It might produce something new, undreamed of in the philosophy of the planner. The principle extends even to games and amusements. I leave it to the reader to guess whether it was in Germany or in Russia that chess players were officially exhorted that we must finish once and for all with the neutrality of chess. We must condemn once and for all the formula chess for the sake of chess, like the formula art for art's sake. Incredible as some of these aberrations may appear, we must yet be on our guard not to dismiss them as mere accidental byproducts which have nothing to do with the essential character of a planned or totalitarian system. They are not. They are a direct result of that same desire to see everything directed by a unitary conception of the whole, of the need to uphold at all costs the views in the service of which people are asked to make constant sacrifices, and of the general idea that the knowledge and beliefs of the people are an instrument to be used for a single purpose. Once science has to serve, not truth, but the interests of a class, a community, or a state, the sole task of argument and discussion is to vindicate and to spread still further the beliefs by which the whole life of the community is directed. As the Nazi Minister of Justice has explained, the question which every new scientific theory must ask itself is, do I serve National Socialism for the greatest benefit of all? The word truth itself ceases to have its old meaning. It describes no longer something to be found, with the individual conscience as the sole arbiter of whether in any particular instance the evidence, or the standing of those proclaiming it, warrants a belief. It becomes something to be laid down by authority, something which has to be believed in the interest of the unity of the organized effort, and which may have to be altered as the exigencies of this organized effort require it. The general intellectual climate which this produces, the spirit of complete cynicism as regards truth which it engenders, the loss of the sense of even the meaning of truth, the disappearance of the spirit of independent inquiry and of the belief in the power of rational conviction, the way in which differences of opinion in every branch of knowledge become political issues to be decided by authority, are all things which one must personally experience. No short description can convey their extent. Perhaps the most alarming fact is that contempt for intellectual liberty is not a thing which arises only once the totalitarian system is established, but one which can be found everywhere among intellectuals who have embraced a collectivist faith and who are acclaimed as intellectual leaders even in countries still under a liberal regime. Not only is even the worst oppression condoned if it is committed in the name of socialism, and the creation of a totalitarian system openly advocated by people who pretend to speak for the scientists of liberal countries, intolerance too is openly extolled. Have we not recently seen a British scientific writer defend even inquisition because, in his opinion, it is beneficial to science when it protects a rising class? This view is, of course, practically indistinguishable from the views which led the Nazis to the persecution of men of science, the burning of scientific books, and the systematic eradication of the intelligentsia of the subjected people. The desire to force upon the people a creed which is regarded as before them is, of course, not a thing that is new or peculiar to our time. New, however, is the argument by which many of our intellectuals try to justify such attempts. There is no real freedom of thought in our society, so it is said, because the opinions and tastes of the masses are shaped by propaganda, by advertising, by the example of the upper classes, and by other environmental factors which inevitably force the thinking of the people into well-worn grooves. From this, it is concluded that if the ideals and tastes of the great majority are always fashioned by circumstances which we can control, we ought to use this power deliberately to turn the thoughts of the people in what we think is a desirable direction. Probably it is true enough that the great majority are rarely capable of thinking independently, that on most questions they accept views which they find ready-made, and that they will be equally content if born or coaxed into one set of beliefs or another. In any society, freedom of thought will probably be of direct significance only for a small minority. but this does not mean that anyone is competent, or ought to have power, to select those to whom this freedom is to be reserved. It certainly does not justify the presumption of any group of people to claim the right to determine what people ought to think or believe. It shows a complete confusion of thought to suggest that, because under any sort of system the majority of people follow the lead of somebody, it makes no difference if everybody has to follow the same lead. To deprecate the value of intellectual freedom because it will never mean for everybody the same possibility of independent thought is completely to miss the reasons which give intellectual freedom its value. What is essential to make it serve its function as the prime mover of intellectual progress is not that everybody may be able to think or write anything, but that any cause or idea may be argued by somebody. So long as dissent is not suppressed, there will always be some who will query the ideas ruling their contemporaries and put new ideas to the test of argument and propaganda. This interaction of individuals, possessing different knowledge and different views, is what constitutes the life of thought. The growth of reason is a social process based on the existence of such differences. It is of its essence that its results cannot be predicted, that we cannot know which views will assist this growth and which will not. In short, that this growth cannot be governed by any views which we now possess without at the same time limiting it. To plan or organize the growth of mind, or for that matter progress in general, is a contradiction in terms. The idea that the human mind ought consciously to control its own development confuses individual reason, which alone can consciously control anything, with the interpersonal process to which its growth is due. By attempting to control it, we are merely setting bounds to its development and must sooner or later produce a stagnation of thought and a decline of reason. The tragedy of collectivist thought is that while it starts out to make reason supreme, it ends by destroying reason because it misconceives the process on which the growth of reason depends. It may indeed be said that it is the paradox of all collectivist doctrine and its demand for conscious control or conscious planning that they necessarily lead to the demand that the mind of some individual should rule supreme, while only the individualist approach to social phenomena makes us recognize the superindividual forces which guide the growth of reason. Individualism is thus an attitude of humility before this social process and of tolerance to other opinions, and is the exact opposite of that intellectual hubris which is at the root of the demand for comprehensive direction of the social process. Chapter 12. The Socialist Roots of All anti-liberal forces are combining against everything that is liberal. A. Müller Vandenbroek. It is a common mistake to regard National Socialism as a mere revolt against reason, an irrational movement without intellectual background. If that were so, the movement would be much less dangerous than it is. But nothing could be further from the truth or more misleading. The doctrines of National Socialism are the culmination of a long evolution of thought, a process in which thinkers who have had great influence far beyond the confines of Germany have taken part. Whatever one may think of the premises from which they started, it cannot be denied that the men who produced the new doctrines were powerful writers who left the impress of their ideas on the whole of European thought. Their system was developed with ruthless consistency. Once one accepts the premises from which it starts, there is no escape from its logic. It is simply collectivism freed from all traces of an individualist tradition which might hamper its realization. Though in this development German thinkers have taken the lead, they were by no means alone. Thomas Carlyle and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, August Comte and George Sorel, part of that continuous development as any Germans. The development of this strand of thought within Germany has been well traced recently by R.D. Butler in his study of The Roots of National Socialism. But although its persistence there through 150 years in almost unchanged and ever-recurring form which emerges from that study is rather frightening, it is easy to exaggerate the importance these ideas had in Germany before 1914. They were only one strand of thought among a people then perhaps more varied in its views than any other, and they were on the whole represented by a small minority and held in as great contempt by the majority of Germans as they were in other countries. What then caused these views held by a reactionary minority finally to gain the support of the great majority of Germans and practically the whole of her youth? It was not merely the defeat, the suffering, and the wave of nationalism which led to their success.
Still less was the cause, as so many people wish to believe, a capitalist reaction against the advance of socialism. On the contrary, the support which brought these ideas to power came precisely from the socialist camp. It was certainly not through the bourgeoisie, but rather through the absence of a strong bourgeoisie, that they were helped to power. The doctrines which had guided the ruling elements in Germany for the past generation were opposed not to the socialism in Marxism, but to the liberal elements contained in it, its internationalism and its democracy. And as it became increasingly clear that it was just these elements which formed obstacles to the realization of socialism, the socialists of the left approached more and more to those of the right. It was the union of the anti-capitalist forces of the right and of the left, the fusion of radical and conservative socialism, which drove out from Germany everything that was liberal. The connection between socialism and nationalism in Germany was close from the beginning. It is significant that the most important ancestors of National Socialism, Fichte, Robertus, and LaSalle, are at the same time acknowledged fathers of socialism. While theoretical socialism in its Marxist form was directing the German labor movement, the authoritarian and nationalist element receded for a time into the background, but not for long. Footnote, and only partially. In 1892, one of the leaders of the Social Democratic Party, August Bebel, was able to tell Bismarck that the Imperial Chancellor can rest assured that German social democracy is a sort of preparatory school for militarism. From 1914 onward, there arose from the ranks of Marxist socialism one teacher after another who led not the conservatives and reactionaries, but the hard-working laborer and idealist youth into the National Socialist fold. It was only thereafter that the tide of nationalist socialism attained major importance and rapidly grew into the Hitlerian doctrine. The war hysteria of 1914, which just because of the German defeat was never fully cured, is the beginning of the modern development which produced National Socialism, and it was largely with the old socialists that it rose during this period. Perhaps the first and in some ways the most characteristic representative of this development is the late Professor Werner Sombart, whose notorious Handler und Helden, Merchants and Heroes, appeared in 1915. Sombart had begun as a Marxian socialist, and as late as 1909 could assert with pride that he had devoted the greater part of his life to fighting for the ideas of Karl Marx. He had done as much as any man to spread socialist ideas and anti-capitalist resentment of varying shades throughout Germany, and if German thought became penetrated with Marxian elements in a way that was true of no other country until the Russian Revolution, this was in a large measure due to Sombart. At one time he was regarded as the outstanding representative of the persecuted socialist intelligentsia, unable because of his radical views to obtain a university chair. And even after the last war, the influence, inside and outside Germany, of his work as a historian, which remained Marxist in approach after he had ceased to be a Marxist in politics, was most extensive and is particularly noticeable in the works of many of the English and American planners. In his war book, this old socialist welcomed the German war as the inevitable conflict between the commercial civilization of England and the heroic culture of Germany. His contempt for the commercial views of the English people, who had lost all warlike instincts, is unlimited. Nothing is more contemptible in his eyes than the universal striving after the happiness of the individual, and what he describes as the leading maxim of English morals, "Be just that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the land," is to him the most infamous maxim which has ever been pronounced by a commercial mind. The German idea of the state, as formulated by Fichte, LaSalle, and Robertus, is that the state is neither founded nor formed by individuals, nor an aggregate of individuals, nor is its purpose to serve any interest of individuals. It is a Volksgemeinschaft in which the individual has no rights but only duties. Claims of the individual are always an outcome of the commercial spirit. The ideas of 1789, liberty, equality, fraternity, are characteristically commercial ideals which have no other purpose but to secure certain advantages to individuals. Before 1914, all the true German ideals of a heroic life were in deadly danger before the continuous advance of English commercial ideals, English comfort, and English sport. The English people had not only themselves become completely corrupted, every trade unionist being sunk in the morass of comfort, but they had begun to infect all other peoples. Only the war had helped the Germans to remember that they were really a people of warriors, a people among whom all activities, and particularly all economic activities, were subordinated to military ends. Sombart knew that the Germans were held in contempt by other people because they regard war as sacred, but he glories in it. To regard war as inhuman and senseless is a product of commercial views. There is a life higher than the individual life, the life of the people and the life of the state, and it is the purpose of the individual to sacrifice himself for that higher life. War is, to Sombart, the consummation of the heroic view of life, and the war against England is the war against the opposite ideal, the commercial ideal of individual freedom and of English comfort, which in his eyes finds its most contemptible expression in the safety razors found in the English trenches.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.